welcome to the College Sports Briefing, your in-depth look at the business, legal, and social issues impacting college athletics today. I'm Daniel Hare, and on today's podcast, we're going to talk about whether college athletes are employees of their institutions and some of the issues surrounding an attempt by Northwestern football players to form a union. We're recording here on Sunday, February 9th. And just for a little overview of where we're going, so Kane Coulter, Northwestern quarterback, kicked off this whole thing. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk more specifically, as I mentioned, about the details of whether college athletes are employees and some of the legal issues that go into determining that. And then where things go from here and what the procedures going forward are going to be, what the timeline might look like, those issues. So let's get right into it. Kane Coulter, the quarterback at Northwestern, kicked this off when he filed a petition earlier in January with the regional National Labor Relations Board in Chicago. And what they were looking for, he and his teammates who joined him, were obviously for better health care, for stipend to cover the full cost of attendance. They weren't specifically, at least in the information they've put out, looking for salaries or for some of the things that are going on in the O'Bannon litigation in regards to participating in licensing royalties from jersey sales or video games or anything like that. But they are looking for health care, both in terms of long-term health care after college athletes exhaust their eligibility, as well as, in more specifically, the head trauma issue. And then obviously the stipend to cover full cost of attendance, which has been something that's been discussed quite a bit recently with the Division I schools, especially the larger schools now in the so-called Big Five conferences, formerly the BCS, have been trying to do that for a while, haven't been able to, but it looks like that they probably will be able to do that once they're able to get some more governing authority over those types of areas, which is something we talked about on the last podcast. So you can go listen to that if you want to get more into that issue. But Kane Coulter and his Northwestern teammates are backed in this by the College Athletes Players Association, as well as the United Steelworkers Union, who I think will play a logistical role in their union should they be able to become one. This petition that was filed would only cover football and men's basketball athletes at private universities. And so that's two different issues that are certainly important, one being just covering football and men's basketball athletes. And so there certainly could potentially be issues with the non-revenue sports, in particular the female sports when it comes to Title IX, what issues may come up there. We're not going to go into that in this podcast, but maybe at a later date we will. And also the fact that the National Labor Relations Board only covers private universities. They don't cover public universities. And so if student athletes at public universities are interested in forming a union, they have to go through their state laws and their procedures under their state. So this would not in any way directly impact state or public institutions, student athletes. So let's get into the details of our college athletes' employees. And this was something I wrote about in quite a bit of detail on the blog, collegesportsbriefs.com, earlier last week. But let's look at it. So without much exception, one being from the 1950s, student athletes have not been designated employees, whether it be for the ability to recover workman's compensation or the ability to be paid more than their scholarship. They have not been recognized in that way. And I mentioned the one exception in the 50s because that was the one time that they were able to, one particular student athlete was able to recover a workman's comp claim, which led to the NCAA coming up with the term student athlete as a way to basically prevent that from happening again. And that's been successful. And so, but however, as we look at the definition of employee within the National Labor Relations Act, which is the law that governs the formation of a union, one thing that you see is that the definition is very broad. In fact, it says that the term employee shall include any employee and shall not be limited to the employees of a particular employer unless the act explicitly states otherwise. It goes on to say, but it shall not include any individual having a status as an independent contractor or by any other person who is not an employer as defined herein. And so it's interesting that you go back and look and say it says the term employee shall include any employee. And so it really doesn't help us much in terms of defining what is an employee for purposes of this act, which is obviously a really key question. And so, you know, if you just want to go back and look at kind of a general Webster's definition and kind of look there, Webster says a person who works for another person or company for wages or a salary is an employee. And, you know, certainly if you want to apply that definition to a student athlete, we know student athletes are people. You know, we know that the activity that they're performing is for a university, so for a company person, certainly fit there. I think one question that's debatable certainly is what they're doing work. If the definition is that they work for this institution, you know, are they doing work? And so I think, you know, we have to look at the fact that students, you know, as they go to class, as they study, as they work on projects, as they take tests, you know, certainly that is, you know, a type of work that they're doing. But I think we would probably all agree that that doesn't make students, just in a general way, employees of their institutions. They're students, and the work that they're doing is for their education and not so much as a benefit to the university in terms of a commercial impact or for profit. And so if you look at, okay, assuming that, however, just for the sake of discussion, that it is work, you know, is it for the university, another person? Yes, we said that. You know, they're not one of the accepted either independent contractor or another employer in the act. So that part is easy. And then the next tricky part, if we kind of assume that the student athletes are working, which is an assumption and one that's debatable, you know, are they working for wages or a salary? And that's really where it does get more interesting. And, you know, if you take walk-on sort of out of the conversation, and we should, because I should point out that the Northwestern petition for unionization does only include scholarship athletes. It doesn't include walk-on athletes. And so, you know, do those scholarship athletes, are they earning compensation? And obviously they're getting tuition, fees, room, board, and books, and is it wages or is it a salary? Because that's the other part of the definition. Are they working for wages or salary? And I don't think you can say that student athletes are working for wages. They're not being paid on, or even if you're calling a scholarship payment, they're not being paid on an hourly basis. They're not punching a time card. They're not turning in time. They're not getting paid biweekly or bimonthly. You know, they're not being paid in that way. However, you know, in terms of the way a salary is defined, usually a set of amount of money for a particular time period, whether it be a month or a year, I think that that could be argued as that the compensation that they're receiving in form of scholarship is a type of salary. And so there's certainly debatable points there. It will be interesting to see how that you know, comes out. And again, we're just looking here at what, you know, a Webster's definition of employee is, since the National Labor Relations Act doesn't really define it for us. But the other, and probably actually more important place to look, is what prior National Labor Relations cases have said, and the boards that have seen these issues come up. What have they said in the past? And while we haven't had a student athlete issue that's come before the board, one group of students that we have had come up through the system that I think is applicable to look at is graduate students and graduate assistants. Those types of graduate students who are either as part of their academic program or sort of as a component maybe of that, as a way to pay for that, are either teaching a class or performing research or something like that. And so, you know, I think that's a pretty close parallel. And what we have there is up from, we had a decision in the 70s that basically said graduate students are not employees for in the work that they do. And that stood all the way up until 2000. And then in 2000, we had a case and that basically said that graduate students are employees. And so let's look at kind of the two cases from the 70s, and then we'll look at the case from 2000. So there was a Stanford case in 1974. And I think the key language that I took out of looking through that case is that their compensation, the graduate student's compensation for maybe teaching a class or doing research, wasn't based upon the work that they did or its intrinsic value, but instead as a manner of providing the students with financial support so that they could go to school. And so that certainly is key language that, you know, could cut against student athletes if you're saying that, you know, it's the way that they're being supported to go to school. And that was really the key language out of the Stanford case, saying graduate students that are doing work with their program are not employees for the purposes of becoming a union. And then a few years later, 1977, you had the St. Clair's case. And in that one, we had even more detailed language, which I think is applicable. And I'll read here. The rationale is a relatively simple and straightforward one. Since the individuals are rendering services which are directly related to and indeed constitute an integral part of their educational program, they are serving primarily as students and not primarily as employees. In our view, this is a very fundamental distinction, for it means that the mutual interests of the students and the educational institution in the services being rendered are predominantly academic rather than economic in nature. Such interests are completely foreign to the normal employment relationship and, in our judgment, are not readily adaptable to the collective bargaining process. So that has a number of different elements in it that we're going to talk through in more detail in just a moment when I return to kind of how I think the student athletes might go about, you know, distinguishing themselves from these prior cases. But before we do that, I mentioned those cases were from the 70s. That's the way it stood all the way up until 2000, where the New York University graduate students and their graduate assistants were able to reverse basically all of that precedent that I just mentioned to you. And the National Labor Relations Board there emphasized what we kind of talked about earlier, the broad definition of employee under the Act, and that students in their role as graduate assistants, at least at NYU in this case, perform services under the control and direction of the employer, that they are compensated by the employer, and therefore meet the common law and statutory definition of an employee. And the key language I think that's really important here is, it says, stripped to its essence, the argument of the employer, NYU in this case, and others, is that graduate assistants who work for a college or university are not entitled to the protections of the Act because they are students. The board's broad and historic interpretation of the Act rejects such a narrow reading of the statute. Accordingly, we will not deprive workers who are compensated by and under the control of a statutory employer of their fundamental statutory rights to organize and bargain with their employer simply because they are also students. And so what this case is basically saying is, look, all of that precedent from the 70s is sort of just out of whack when the only real reason that you're saying the graduate students are not employees is because they're students. And that just simply doesn't line up with what we read as the intent of the statute. So that was the case in 2000 with New York University. And then in 2004, just 4 years later, we have that case reversed. And this is in a Brown University case, and it basically goes back and cites all of the old precedents, and it's going back to that. It says that graduate students' relationship with their school is more academic in nature than economic. It cites the language from the Stanford and St. Clair's case that we referenced earlier, and it specifically hit on this language that specifically excluded from the employee class those who perform services at their educational institutions which are directly related to their educational program. And so we have all of this precedent going back and forth from the 70s cases to 2000, now back to 2004. And first of all, you know, why it's going back and forth? Well, one thing to keep in mind when it comes to the National Labor Relations Board is that it's a five-person board, and each of those people are appointed by the president. And so it is an appointed position that tends to obviously trend with the political affiliations and the party of who's in the White House. So you can kind of guess that when the 2000 case was decided, we had had a National Labor Relations Board that had been filled with President Clinton appointees. And so when it's a Democratic president, you tend to have a little bit more, you know, union-friendly decisions and granting more union rights to more people than you do when there's a Republican administration and a Republican-appointed National Labor Relations Board, which is what we had in 2004. By the time that that case came through, it was primarily President Bush appointees that were making that decision. And so I think you can go ahead and assume that no matter what happens, at least until we have this issue resolved by the Supreme Court or in a federal appellate court, is that we're going to have a back and forth on this issue, or we could potentially, depending on whoever is in the White House. Now, this is all great, except we're not talking about student athletes. It doesn't directly apply because we're talking about graduate students. But, you know, how could we, you know, apply it to our student athletes and the Northwestern folks in this case? Well, one thing is if the National Labor Relations Board decides, because they're, you know, President Obama appointees, probably more inclined to grant union rights than not, and therefore more likely to have a broad interpretation of the definition of employee than maybe their previous counterparts. So if they were to decide to reinstate the NYU case or the NYU precedent, then student athletes might be in pretty good shape there if they're able to do that. If that doesn't happen, I think student athletes could still potentially, distinguish their situation from some of the unfavorable decisions that we've talked about, the 1970s cases and then the more recent Brown case. And here's a few of the reasons why. Number one, the work that they're performing is not a core part of their academic program. That was something that came up quite a bit through the precedent that, you know, a lot of the graduate students who are doing research or teaching, that's a part of their academic degree requirements. They can't graduate with their graduate degree without having done that work. And that's not the case in the situation of a student athlete. The student athlete, you know, is certainly, participating, spending a lot of time and hours on their sport. And certainly there's an educational component to it, but it's not directly applicable to their degree program. And so that's where I think there's a distinction. Number two, financial aid is based on the work and not simply a form of financial aid, like a fellowship might be. Some of these cases in the past, the graduate assistant was receiving financial aid, maybe, and teaching a class, but other graduate students in the same program were receiving financial aid as well and not having to do any work at all. And so, you know, in those cases, you know, they're really, that's one way that they were able to say that that type of financial aid was more geared towards academic programming and student related as opposed to an employee and a commercial benefit. But in the student athlete's case, obviously, their financial aid is based off of their work and based off of their participation as an athlete. If they're not able to get an athletic scholarship just for going to school and without participating in the sport. And so that's certainly one reason. A third one would be that financial aid can be pulled after any year if a student athlete isn't performing at the level the coach finds acceptable, or if the coach is able to find someone better to take their place. We've seen some schools take advantage of more or less restrictive rules recently to extend multi-year scholarship offers, but still relatively few are doing that. And there's still really a high level of standard for student athletes. And if they don't meet those, oftentimes they're not renewed in terms of their scholarship. And so it is contingent upon their work and the level of their work. And so that's another way. And a fourth one is just the commercial and economic component of major college athletics in general, and the amount of revenue that it brings in, the amount of business that is involved, just all of the economic factors. You know, can we say that a student athlete's role in terms of their athletic performance is more student oriented or more commercial and economic oriented? You know, I don't don't think we can say that for sure. I'm sure there's an argument either way, but I think that you can't just say similar that it's more like a graduate student who's teaching a class or doing research, in terms of what's the, and that's more of a student impact than what I think the student athletes are doing, which is more of an economic and commercial impact. And fifth and lastly, the primary mutual interest between the athlete and the university, that was the language that was used in the St. Clair's case, that primary mutual interest is more commercial than academic in nature, I think I would argue. And just because of the way that the student athletes are performing, again, like we were saying earlier, and they have to perform at a certain level to maintain their financial aid, that their performance is the indicators of whether revenue is generated. And, again, none of that is tied to their degree program and towards their graduation. And so I think that that's something that we just can't overlook. So with all that being said, where do we go from here? Well, the Regional National Labor Relations Board will make a determination on the Northwestern football players. And though we also could see other private school athletes join in the meantime. So before decisions made, we may see other private school student athletes join up. Again, not public student athletes, not public school student athletes for the reasons we mentioned earlier. They're not covered by this. Then no matter what that decision is, it will likely be appealed to the national level board that is filled with the presidential appointees. And so we'll see that. And then most likely, or certainly very likely, is that decision could be appealed over into the appellate court system, the federal court system, and it ultimately end up in the United States Supreme Court. And so we're looking at certainly months before any type of initial decision and potentially years of litigation on this issue. And if players eventually lost, they could certainly form some type of association to collectively lobby for greater benefits with schools and with the NCAA. It wouldn't have the leverage that a union would have, but it could still give them a little bit more say and a little bit more of a voice, more power, which I think would all be good things for the student athletes. Most likely, though, this will continue to add pressure to the NCAA and the universities to enhance benefits, especially when it comes to compensation, when it comes to healthcare and long-term healthcare. And so if the NCAA and universities can be responsive to that, potentially it's something where the pursuit of becoming a union dies out, is not necessary anymore, at least in the eyes of those who are trying to get this done at this point. And then interestingly, if you designate employees, student athletes employees, and allow them to collectively bargain, that would actually make the O'Bannon case moot because you would then have student athletes working within a collective bargaining system, which those laws trump antitrust laws. And so you don't have antitrust concerns or issues once you've gone to a collective bargaining system. Now, it wouldn't obviously impact all of the previous student athletes that have come before and haven't been under that a new collective bargaining employee union system. So it would only impact those from going forward. But still, it would make any future or student athletes immune from that, basically. So the O'Bannon case would go forward for the previous student athletes, current student athletes, as it would. But in terms of the big future impact of the O'Bannon case, it wouldn't, because you would have collective bargaining laws, which would trump any antitrust issues. Well, gosh, we've covered a lot, and that's all the time we have for today's episode. And I do want to thank you for being here. This is actually just our second podcast, but we're going to be on an every 2-week publishing schedule for the podcast, and of course, blog posts in between. So please go over to the blog, collegesportsbriefs.com, for show notes and links to the things we've talked about today, as well as other articles on college sports law and business. You can also check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/collegesportsbriefs, and also follow me on Twitter @DanielHare. And I really appreciate you listening and hope you enjoyed this edition of the College Sports Briefing.